The headlines: the number of people who have died in floods in Western Europe rises to at least 126. Russia reports 799 coronavirus-related deaths, the highest in a single day since the pandemic began. And South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the deadly unrest in his country over the past week was planned in advance. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story for this half-hour: these 126 people have been killed in days of torrential rains and flooding in Western Europe. Germany is the worst affected country that has reported 103 fatalities so far. More than 1,300 people also remain unaccounted for. Officials in two German states of North Rhine-Westphalia and Rhineland-Palatinate have warned that the number could go up as the situation remains difficult to assess. Belgium has also confirmed at least 23 deaths. Luxembourg and the Netherlands have evacuated thousands of people. Meanwhile, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has reacted to the unprecedented situation, saying the floods are a clear indication of climate change.
It is the intensity and the length of these events where science tells us this is a clear indication of climate change.
Speaking in the Irish capital, Dublin, von der Leyen added that the situation in Western Europe shows urgency to act on climate change. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier has also expressed shock at the extent of damage, highlighting that it was time to battle climate change. More heavy rain has been predicted across the region, with experts blaming climate change for the flooding. Well, Russia has reported nearly 800 coronavirus-related new deaths, the highest in a single day since the pandemic broke out there. Friday marks the fourth straight day the country has logged record daily fatalities from the virus. Russia's coronavirus task force also confirmed nearly 26,000 new infections for the past day. The country's total caseload is now inching closer to 6 million, while its death toll is hovering around 147,000. Russia has been grappling with the third wave of the pandemic since April. Authorities blame the Delta variant and people's reluctance to get vaccinated as the reason for the spike. The capital, Moscow, and the second-largest city, St. Petersburg, remain the epicenters of the recent outbreak. Russia is the worst-hit country in Europe by the pandemic in terms of both infections and deaths. Well, Iran has logged almost 22,000 new COVID-19 infections in the last 24 hours, raising its total caseload to nearly 3.5 million. The health ministry also confirmed some 200 new fatalities for the past day. The country's death toll from the virus is now inching closer to 87,000. Over 4,000 COVID patients are currently in intensive care units. Iran has been grappling with a new surge in infections and deaths over the past couple of weeks. The uptick is largely blamed on the highly contagious Delta strain of the virus. Nearly 170 cities are now designated as red, the highest level in the country's four-tier system of COVID restrictions. Stringent measures are in place in those cities to curb the spread of the virus. So far, nearly 2.5 million people have received two doses of a COVID vaccine nationwide. And South Korean authorities are considering tighter coronavirus restrictions as the number of daily infections keeps surging there. The government says gatherings would be limited to less than four people in non-metropolitan area after 6 p.m. if cases continue to rise. Such limits, along with other curbs, have already been in place in the greater Seoul area since Monday. The region accounted for about 75% of the nearly 1,500 cases posted Thursday. South Korea has so far been successful in controlling its COVID outbreaks. However, the more contagious Delta variant has fueled a fourth wave of infections among the unvaccinated. Daily infections there have been 1,000 or above since July the 7th.
South Korea has been hit hard by a fourth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, with new daily cases over 1,000 for the past week. More than 50% of the recent new cases have been the more contagious Delta variant. The government has issued a number of restrictions and guidelines, including banning gatherings of more than two people, other than family, after 6 p.m.
외출과 모임은 자제하고, Please refrain from going out or holding social gatherings and abide by the disinfection guidelines wherever you are. Even if you don't have symptoms, please protect yourself and your loved ones by getting tested. We can and must overcome this crisis. The government will do its best.
Bae Hyung Won and his wife operate a small seafood restaurant in Incheon, just outside of Seoul. He diligently disinfects his restaurant, adhering to social distancing protocols and other government guidelines. He says a lot of businesses in the neighborhood are just hanging on.
The current situation is affecting us tremendously. Up to now, the first to third waves of the coronavirus weren't so bad. But as soon as the fourth wave started, from the first day, the number of customers plunged by 80 to 90%.
As many countries around the world are now opening up, South Korea is under more pressure from the rest of public to respond more effectively to the outbreak. Young people have been especially critical, as they will wait months for their shots amid shortages of vaccine supplies. The South Korean government had set a goal of November to achieve herd immunity. Currently, about 12% of the population has been fully vaccinated, while health officials emphasize the importance of the next 2 months in containing the recent wave of infections. Frank Smith, Seoul.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says the deadly unrest in his country over the past week was planned in advance.
And it's quite clear that this, all these incidents of unrest and looting were instigated. There are instigators. There were people who planned it. They coordinated it.
Ramaphosa expressed concern over rising racial tensions in some parts of the country. He said his government would not allow anarchy and mayhem to prevail. The South African president was speaking to media as he visited KwaZulu-Natal province. That's one of the worst hit areas in the unrest. The violence broke out after former President Jacob Zuma began his 15-month jail term for refusing to appear at a corruption inquiry. Officials say 117 people were killed and more than 1,700 arrested. They also say a dozen suspects have been identified in connection with the violence. Iran's foreign minister has dismissed U.S. allegations that Iranian intelligence services were involved in an abduction plot on American soil. Mohammad Javad Zarif said the alleged kidnapping operation was, quote, patently ridiculous and childishly conceived. He added the accusation is aimed at covering up Washington's own criminal ties to gunmen hatching plots in the U.S. to assassinate leaders in Venezuela and Haiti. Zarif called on the U.S. to put its house in order before throwing bricks at others. On Tuesday, the U.S. Justice Department accused four Iranian intelligence agents of conspiring to kidnap an anti-Islamic Republic figure in New York for rendition to Iran. Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel says the United States' efforts to destroy his country have failed despite spending billions of dollars to do so. Díaz-Canel said, a failed state is the one that multiplies the damage to 11 million human beings, ignoring the will of the majority of Cubans, Americans, and the international community. He said such a policy is to please itself by blackmailing a reactionary minority. He cited the U.S. trade embargo in place against his country since 1962, which was enforced under former President Donald Trump. The reaction came after U.S. President Joe Biden on Thursday described Cuba as a failed state and accused it of repressing its citizens. The Caribbean island nation has been witnessing anti-government protests since Sunday over the worst economic crisis in decades. Cuba has blamed the United States for the unrest. Afghan officials say government forces have launched an operation to retake a key border crossing with Pakistan from Taliban militants. Heavy fighting is going on in the Spinbol-Dak border crossing as Taliban insurgents have reportedly taken shelter in civilian homes. The border point provides direct access to Pakistan's Balochistan province. That's where the Taliban's top leadership has been based for decades now. The crossing fell to the Taliban earlier this week. The militant group has also captured Afghan border crossings with Iran and Turkmenistan. They stepped up their attacks in May, taking control of a swath of territories in Afghanistan. The military has pledged to retake all those areas. Our correspondent Tamin Alimi quotes Afghan authorities as saying the military has regained control of some territories captured by the Taliban.
The Afghan government officials here in Afghanistan's defense ministry says that Afghan military forces have retaken the control over some of key districts, mainly in northern and southern parts of Afghanistan. One of those key districts and areas is Ispin Buldak, that connects southern Kandahar province to neighboring Pakistan. Ispin Buldak is also home to the former police commander of Kandahar province, who was well known for his anti-Taliban stances. After capturing this area, I mean Ispin Buldak, the Taliban militants also entered the house of this former Kandahar police chief and even burned all of what were inside this house. In the meantime, the Taliban spokesman also says that they have gained major achievements not only in Ispin Buldak but also in Wish, that is the main border point between Pakistan and Afghanistan in the southern parts of southern part of this country. On the other hand, the Afghan government officials say that Afghan military forces have retaken Chakhansur district from the Taliban militants located in western Nimruz province, southern Nimruz province of Afghanistan.
Well, with the European Union threatening to impose sanctions against Lebanese politicians, Saad Hariri has decided to step down, citing fundamental disagreements with President Aoun. Experts believe the current socioeconomic, financial, and political collapse could be the end of the current governing system in Lebanon.
Following a declaration by Saad Hariri that he would step down as prime minister designate, angry mobs blocked roads and clashed with the army. The price of the dollar against the Lebanese lira was skyrocketing, hinting a gloomy outlook on the horizon. In an interview Thursday night, Hariri blamed President Aoun for impeding the cabinet formation process and for his resignation.
The group led by the president has decided not to cooperate with Saad Hariri, and all the obstacles that I have faced are because of that group. I did not want to just negotiate while knowing that I cannot form a cabinet, so I resigned because it seemed to me that President Aoun does not want to form a cabinet.
Presidential office slammed Hariri for his comments, declaring that Hariri was, quote, not ready to discuss amendments of any kind, and closed the door on any talks. Experts see that Hariri is now launching an internal conflict, using resistance as a scapegoat.
It was obvious that he's preparing for his election campaign, because later in his interview yesterday night, he launched his election campaign by opening fire on the resistance in Lebanon.
Observers see that talk of electoral campaigns will be the main focus in the post-Hariri resignation era.
The Americans, they haven't reached a point to let the solution take place. They are still using the financial crisis as a blackmailing means to try to blackmail the resistance in Lebanon.
The state of despair on the streets of Beirut is a reflection of the general situation.
Everyone knew there would not be a new cabinet. The country has collapsed. If the prime minister wanted to actually form a cabinet, he would go for real negotiations. The result will be death of the people, no electricity, no water, and no fuel. Lebanon has fallen.
All the people need to protest. The rich and the poor are equal now, and all six are facing the same crisis.
They all want a piece of cheese for themselves. If they cannot rule right, they should leave. People are helpless. Hunger knows no religion or sect.
With the socioeconomic crisis quickly escalating, many believe the end result will be a probable demise of the entire political system.
French sources described Hariri's move as cynical self-destruction for the political class. Others considered it the start of an electoral campaign. But one thing all sides agree on is that it puts Lebanon in the face of a chaotic period ahead. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
The United Arab Emirates is moving closer to Israel despite widespread calls to reconsider its policy toward the regime. Economic considerations are largely at play when it comes to the controversial détente.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv's Stock Exchange building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital, Abu Dhabi, and a consulate in the UAE's business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back.
And that brings us to an end here on this edition of the World News. Stay tuned, though. Bye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new study of Gaza's reconstruction needs, published by the UN, EU, and World Bank, demonstrates anew the harmful role played by these institutions in Palestine. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Maureen Claire Morphy, senior editor of the electronic Intifada. This article is published under the heading UN, EU, and World Bank Back Siege on Gaza. Stay tuned for more. A new study of Gaza's reconstruction needs, published by the UN, EU, and World Bank, demonstrates anew the harmful role played by these institutions in Palestine. The authors of the Rapid Damage and Needs Assessment, as the UN, EU, and World Bank called their study, go to great lengths to minimize Israeli regime responsibility for the dire situation in Gaza, exacerbated by the latest episode of bombardment in May. They use the passive voice throughout in an approach bid to downplay the Zionist regime's direct role in the destruction, for which reconstruction will cost some $345 to $485 million and take 2 years to complete. That is assuming Israeli regime won't obstruct it at every turn. Israeli regime leaders have sought to condition reconstruction on the return of Israelis held in Gaza. Rebuilding took place at a snail's pace after the last war, so there is every reason to believe that it will delay and hinder rebuilding once again. The authors of the rapid assessment state that the May 2021 conflict caused damage to Gaza's roads as if this were some unfortunate act of God rather than the result of missiles deliberately fired by the Zionist regime military at civilian infrastructure. In one such attack, an Israeli regime strike made a giant crater in one of the main roads leading to Al-Shifa Hospital, Gaza's largest medical facility, blocking the movement of ambulances. Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, said that the attack on the main roads leading to Al-Shifa amounts to making the hospital the object of the attack. The Zionist regime killed more than 40 Palestinians in that series of strikes on Gaza city of Wehda Street. But these specifics are omitted from the rapid assessment, which describes Palestinian needs in detail, but treats the Israeli regime's responsibility in abstraction, if at all. The Zionist regime siege and its deleterious effects on every aspect of life in Gaza are impossible to ignore, even for the UN, EU, and the World Bank. But these international institutions legitimize the Zionist regime siege on Gaza by stating that it was imposed due to security concerns. Yet the study's authors don't attribute this as a claim made by the Zionist regime and instead shockingly present it as a given. This shamefully whitewashes a plainly cruel and immoral siege that the International Committee of the Red Cross has affirmed amounts to collective punishment imposed in clear violation of the Zionist regime's obligations under international humanitarian law, that is, a war crime. As Al-Mizan, a human rights group based in Gaza, writes, the Zionist regime's closure regime cannot be justified under any circumstances. The Zionist regime's policies in Gaza may amount to the crimes against humanity of persecution and other inhumane acts. By accepting the premise that security concerns justify the siege, the UN, EU, and World Bank demonstrate an eagerness to sanctify Israel's subjugation of the Palestinians living under its settler colonial rule. The true purpose of the siege on Gaza is not to protect the Israeli regime's security. Instead, it is to secure regime change by bringing Gaza's economy to its knees to weaken Hamas' resistance movement. The Zionist regime long ago admitted that the siege on Gaza is economic warfare. After all, it is hard to see how counting the calories that the Zionist regime allows into Gaza could reasonably be considered a security measure. Gaza has been under some degree of Israeli regime closure for the past half century, decades before Hamas came onto the scene. The Zionist regime has long isolated Gaza, rendering the territory a segregated, debilitated and subjugated colony, as Ronnie Smith observed in 2019. The Zionist regime manufactures humanitarian crises through a siege to create permanent isolation and deprivation, which is supported by the international community through its political inaction and its supplying of humanitarian aid in spite of Israeli regime's legal obligations, according to Smith. The Zionist regime does this because most of the 2 million Palestinians in Gaza are refugees with claims to return to their lands in what is now called occupied Palestine, claims supported by the international law. As Smith writes, that is an untenable prospect for a settler colonial state premised on ethnic purity. But why would the UN, EU, and World Bank back the security concerns excuse for a policy that has plunged Gaza's population of 2 million into profound levels of poverty, aid dependency, food insecurity, and unemployment, as described by Al-Mizan, because they share the same regime change goal as the Israeli regime, as is made clear in the Rapid Assessment Report. These international institutions that have crowned themselves in charge of rebuilding Gaza want to see the restoration of Palestinian authority rule in the territory, as well as the internal Palestinian reconciliation and the democratically elected Palestinian Authority. The UN, EU, and World Bank want Palestinians to capitulate to the Israeli regime and surrender to its rule. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime has tightened its siege following the May offensive. Rather than unequivocally calling on the Israeli regime to lift restrictions, the UN, EU, and World Bank seek international efforts to support reform and strengthen the mechanism to facilitate and accelerate the import of sensitive goods and materials needed to rebuild Gaza's economic infrastructure and business sector. It's a somewhat oblique reference to the scandalous UN-enforced Gaza reconstruction mechanism devised after the 2014 offensive, allowing the Israeli regime to exercise total control over what building materials are allowed into the territory. In other words, the UN, EU, and World Bank want to support reform and strengthen Israeli regime restrictions on the Palestinian economy, particularly in Gaza, rather than do away with them altogether. These institutions are, meanwhile, promoting a building back better approach, ensuring that recovery and reconstruction efforts factor in resilience and sustainability and reduce Gaza's vulnerabilities. But for that to actually happen, Palestinians need to be free of the Israeli regime's colonial domination and the agenda of the international institutions that support it.
We the people.
U.S. hunger crisis.
The issue of hunger is usually considered a serious problem, widely associated with certain poor countries such as Sierra Leone in West Africa or Haiti in the Caribbean. But hunger and food insecurity is an everyday reality of millions of people living in a powerful and rich country like the United States.
Sometimes embarrassing, but it's what you have to go through.
Is there a night that you and your husband go without food just to make sure the kids have food?
Most of the time. We will make sure that they have had their portion and maybe another portion before we would eat. And me and Dad have kind of gotten to the point of now that we only eat maybe once a day. All right, y'all. Let's settle down.
Hello and welcome to our show, We the People, where we investigate political and economic issues related to the United States. And in this episode, a topic many might find unlikely: hunger in one of the most developed countries in the world. But why? Isn't there sufficient food stuff in America? What about programs aimed at providing food for the poor? Stay with us as we search for answers to these critical questions. Thank you.
It's kind of hard when you don't live in the state of West Virginia to be able to understand what really goes on here. It's like feast or famine at this point, you know, survival of the fittest.
I pulled myself up by the bootstraps so many damn times that I've ripped them off. I have two jobs and a bachelor's degree, and I struggle to make ends meet.
When lack of money and other resources leads to disruption of food intake or eating patterns, the situation is referred to as food insecurity. Limited or uncertain access to adequate food obviously abounds in the United States. Although the U.S. is one of the most powerful and wealthiest countries in the world, it indeed has a hunger problem.
There was, back in the 1990s, a moment when it was clear that military families were beginning to apply for food stamps, what we now call SNAP. And there was a concern about the optics of this. So in their infinite wisdom, the military and Congress created a program that was designed to provide a supplemental subsistence allowance. And that was almost identical to the SNAP program, but only available to military.
The number of families unable to put food on the table has grown in recent years. This is while official estimates show that there is no real shortage of food in the U.S., as there exists more than enough food to feed every single person in the country. So what's going on? We reached out to Daniel Kovalik to investigate the issue. He's a professor of international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Welcome, Professor Kovalik. First of all, isn't it strange that there is still hunger in the U.S., which promotes itself as the leader of the developed countries in the world?
Well, yes, of course. And, I would turn people's attention to a 2018 report that was done by the U.N., I believe it was the UN High Commission for Human Rights on Poverty in the U.S., which talked about this issue, that you had at that time 40 million people who were food insecure. That number has gone up, especially after the pandemic. And look at the pandemic numbers themselves. The U.S., the richest country in the world, so far still has the worst COVID numbers on Earth in terms of the most people who've been impacted and the most numbers of deaths.
Many thanks. Stay tuned to hear more of Professor Kovalik's analysis later on in the program.
Children are probably the most vulnerable victims of the growing hunger crisis in America, a top food producer itself, where a whole lot of food is wasted, as more than 42 million people experience food insecurity in the United States. Millions of children have to rely on school for their regular meals. Hunger in America has soared to historic levels in the past few years, especially for children.
My favorite vegetable is carrots.
Why?
Because carrots are healthy for your eyes, and they have lots of vitamins.
My favorite vegetable is an apple, because it's nice and sweet, and you could really, eat, a lot.
But, as with most activities involving children...
Which vegetable don't you like at all, and why?
The celery, because sometimes when I taste it, I just get a nasty taste to it.
Families with young children across the country are facing their hungriest times today. There are an estimated 17 million children battling hunger, 6 million more than before the pandemic, according to official data. So how significant are these numbers? To find out, we're now joined by Don DeBar, activist and commentator based in Westchester, New York. Thank you for joining the show, sir. What is your take on the status of hunger in America?
hunger has been a problem in the United States, a serious problem in the United States, most of my life, and I'm 67 years old. I was born in 1954. I have seen in the process of researching this topic over time, for example, in 1968 CBS news coverage of hunger in America, there were millions of food starving people in the United States in 1968. Since then, we've lost most of the union jobs. We have lost the many of the benefits that people had to protect them against unemployment.
Many thanks for your insights, activist and commentator Don DeBar.
Food insecurity has exacerbated considerably since the coronavirus pandemic began. More than 35 million people in the United States were already experiencing hunger back in 2019. With the COVID pandemic, life became much harder for the poor, and that number started to grow. Today, hunger is part and parcel of life in every single community in the United States.
Feeding Tampa Bay has been spending close to $250,000 a month, if not more, buying food, because the need is much greater than we've ever experienced. And so as a result, we have to do more. Post-COVID, we're delivering 2 million meals every week across our 10 counties. And it's important for folks to know that still is not enough. That still does not meet the entire need.
Families suffering from hunger do not have access to food or enough food. Many wonder how they will get their next meal, regardless of whether it would be nutritionally valuable. Therefore, living an active and healthy life is a challenge for millions of people as they try to survive in a land where they keep being promised the so-called American dream. But how has the coronavirus pandemic specifically made life harder for food insecure families?
Many people were thrown out of work. Many people lost not only jobs and careers, but many lost businesses. So of course, that in and of itself, when people are thrown out of work and into poverty, would increase the numbers of food insecure people. Moreover, there was a breakdown in the supply networks due to COVID, due to the lockdowns, which also increased food insecurity. And in addition, of course, it increased homelessness. You have a lot more homeless on the streets of American cities.
When the global pandemic hit the United States, it caused two crises: a healthcare and an economic crisis. With businesses closed, many Americans lost their jobs, facing economic pressure to provide for their families.
I get paid biweekly, and sometimes we ran out of food. This pandemic has impacted me emotionally. I don't know where my food was going to come from next. What has stopped me from applying for additional benefits like food stamps? I'm hoping this will ride out and finish or
come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I first found out about the food drive online. At first, it was a big thing for me not to go down there because of my pride. And there's a lot of people that won't go because they're like, oh, I don't need that. Let's save it for family that really does. And when I realized, hey, I'm a family that really does.
There are also the unexpected medical bills piled up on top of expenses soaring during the pandemic. That created a surge of families desperate for food. Not all those facing hunger are considered poor. Many are just people who have lost their jobs after the coronavirus pandemic began.
When you start out in February of 2020 with millions of people being food insecure, housing insecure, in foreclosure and or eviction proceedings, and you have then pandemic and the closing of many businesses and the loss of millions and millions of jobs, what you're doing in essence is exacerbating an already structural problem.
Like other hardships, hunger does not affect Americans equally. Although it exists in all communities, but food insecurity harms certain people more than others. Racial minorities, namely African Americans, Hispanics, and indigenous Americans, are hit much harder by the crisis, in part due to systemic racism embedded within the U.S. institutions.
About 19 million people in America live in a food desert. And Johns Hopkins research shows that food deserts disproportionately affect people of color. Food deserts can be detrimental to its residents' health. I grew up living in a food desert myself in Baltimore. There were absolutely no grocery stores, pharmacies, or retail stores within miles of the area I lived in. We either ate processed food or we bought junk food at the nearest corner store. And well, with the combination of poor diet and other factors, the people in my household had chronic illnesses, and one even passed away prematurely because of it.
Rural Americans also experience higher rates of food insecurity compared to those living in suburban and urban areas. African Americans are said to be twice more likely to experience food insecurity than white non-Hispanic households. Hunger is also a problem for the growing number of senior citizens struggling with food insecurity.
And in rural areas as well, you have increased food insecurity and poverty. Meanwhile, it should be noted that while the poor and working class lost billions and billions of dollars of wealth during the pandemic, the rich gained trillions of dollars of wealth. So there was a massive transfer of wealth from the bottom to the top as a consequence of the pandemic and the lockdowns, which were done in a way that benefited big companies, benefited the rich, and hurt the poor.
The number of those suffering from hunger and food insecurity may be rising, but life has also become more difficult for those who were already suffering from hunger even before the pandemic hit. Many are persuaded to rely on programs such as food stamps or SNAP, as well as charity initiatives seeking to feed families and children.
Programs like Share Our Strength and No Kid Hungry, our campaign, went into immediate action to make sure grants were issued to schools to provide food, to provide PPE for curbside distribution of meals, to provide transportation for children living in rural or urban communities where their families could not get to the schools to pick up meals. All of these things were happening so quickly, and this is still going on. We're going into a holiday season, and the lines that you're showing on television at food banks continue to grow. Families are continuing to struggle, and these numbers continue to skyrocket.
The efforts remain inadequate in the Biden administration, which has sought to boost food stamps after it was heavily attacked by former President Donald Trump. The Biden administration has vowed to fight hunger in America. But what are the plans, and how successful could they be?
I think it's an issue that is not being dealt with, except by charities, by churches, by private institutions. The government has done little to deal with this problem, and it can just continues to increase in America. Again, I think the way that the lockdowns took place, the way that the so-called stimulus plans that were passed to deal with the pandemic and the lockdowns, the way those things were structured benefited the rich and hurt the poor. Again, there can be no dispute about this.
Americans are no stranger to the scenes of cars lining up at food banks today. The Biden administration has been pushing for an increase in the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP. SNAP is a federal program that helps millions of low-income Americans put food on the table. Across the United States, there are 9.5 million families with children on SNAP. The number of food insecure Americans is growing all the time.
It just seemed like, you know, we're never getting ahead. We need some more money. We need another income to kind of make things happen. So we decided Stephen was going to look for work, too. And he found work as a bus driver, a school bus driver, and which is great. And we found a child care provider in the neighborhood who's been great. And so he started working. But once we had a few paychecks under our belts and we had to submit our report to the food stamps people, we found out we didn't qualify for food stamps anymore. We gained some income by him going to work, but then we lost $300 on the food stamps every month. And we lost money to childcare because he was working. So we still come out a little bit ahead, but somehow it never seems that way.
That's the answer.
Potato.
Potato.
Formerly known as the Food Stamp Program, SNAP is the largest federal food assistance program to provide low-income Americans with cash benefits to purchase food. It's also supposed to offer reductions in healthcare costs. After all, food insecurity has skyrocketed through the pandemic for many Americans, but it has been an issue long before the novel crisis.
The UN, in its 2018 report, reported that in places like West Virginia, and in Alabama, in certain places in Alabama, you have huge areas without running water or sewage. Of course, you have Flint, Michigan, that has this now 5+ years of lead in their water, and Flint is not alone in that regard. The U.S. is, and I believe the UN has said this, the only country in the world so far that has de-developed. It is no longer a developed country. It is a third world country. And yes, for the U.S. to claim that somehow it is superior to other countries in this regard is just a joke.
Hundreds of thousands of hardworking individuals in the United States are truly living paycheck to paycheck. Therefore, one disruption, such as the COVID-19 pandemic, could really send somebody over the edge, unable to make ends meet.
Your husband is fully employed. How are you doing financially?
We were living paycheck to paycheck. He was bringing home $500 a week. So I found a job in a restaurant to become a server. First time ever being a server.
Are you still there?
Nope. I left, like, being busy the entire shift. And at the end of the night, have $60. That was crazy to me. I knew I was worth more than that. I knew I could make more than that somewhere. So I finally went out to Carmel, which is like 45-minute drive away from where I live, one way. And I got the job out there. They're richer out there. They spend money. They don't care about spending money.
So the tips are better.
Tips are way better. You get at least 20%. So you're making anywhere from $10 to $20 per table.
With the country's nutritional safety net stretched way too thin due to the global pandemic, the Biden administration must increase aid. But rushing more food assistance to more people is not enough, as it will not solve the problem, although it might help families with their nutritional needs. The federal government also needs to provide a permanent safety program.
You have, over the years, but in particularly during the pandemic, this massive shift of wealth from the poor and working class to the 1% of America that now owns about 50% of the nation's wealth. Of course, the very redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top means that you have an increase in poverty and extreme poverty in the United States. And who is this affected? It's affected people across the stratum of American society. It has affected poor people in the cities, particularly people of color, African Americans, Latinos.
Due to the dark history of inequality, racism, and slavery in the United States, hunger has always been a painful source of struggle for the people. U.S. economic recession, such as the one in 2008, have turned hunger into a crisis for the U.S. government, here to stay for an indefinite length of time. And not just hunger, but all issues related to lack of access to food, such as the so-called food deserts.
There's a lot of money in Memphis, and there's a lot of poverty. You know, we have parts in South Memphis where whole streets and blocks are just vacant. It's like a war that people left due to some catastrophe, but it was just white flight and sprawl. And so what used to be a small family-owned grocery store is now a vacant building, and on one end of it, they have a liquor store that's typical of South and North Memphis. Nobody is going to be attracted in terms of grocery stores, retail, to an area that is sparsely populated and looks and feels dangerous.
Worrying about running out of food or just skipping a meal to make sure your children have enough to eat has become a reality for many American families. With the economy recovering after a recession, hunger persists and takes much longer to return to normal. The hunger caused by the 2008 recession took almost a decade to return to normal levels.
A warning of sacrifices and rewards among the population follows the same, the same direction, essentially, that the operation of the economy has followed for 40 or 50 years. That is, most of the benefits go to the very few at the top. In this case, we're talking about the benefits that were given to Big Pharma, for example, who were encouraged and to funded, all of the things that were done to develop vaccines the absolving liability and all of that. On the other hand, people who were working hand to mouth already, so that like waitresses, food service people, saw their jobs evaporate when their places of employment were closed down.
For now, the problem of food insecurity persists. When people are thrown out of work, it means they just do not have the money to be able to afford to eat in the ways that they used to. It is no surprise that when the economy begins to suffer, hunger begins to rise.
Before Corona came, this line was never this long, so it's definitely bringing more people out here.
We try to address long-term food insecurity. We're seeing new families, families that have never come to us before, families that have been struggling to survive and have been very successful at doing that. But with COVID, with the loss of jobs, we're seeing those families return to us and return to a situation where they need us on a much more regular basis.
The U.S. government has not shown a great performance in the past years in dealing with the crisis. COVID-19 has indeed worsened the situation in the low-income families generally. It is crucial to note that while some suffer more than others, having access to adequate nutrition has to be a top priority for the whole nation. Thank you for staying with us on We the People. Tune in again next week when we come back with another episode. I'm your host, Mila Java Mardi. Have a good time.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.